This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Today's show was pre-recorded, so we won't be taking any calls. From the days of wooden bleachers and playing fields put together in a matter of weeks for a few thousand dollars, to today's massive stadiums that can run into the billions to build, the design of the ballpark has been ever-evolving. Along the way, many of the classic ballparks of the past have been lost to fire or demolition. And in the case of an Alaskan ballpark built in a tidal pool, dredged away. Many Reds fans may never have heard of the Palace of the Fans, once located at Findlay and Western in Cincinnati. The palace was torn down in 1911 and replaced by Redland Field, which would later become known as Crosley Field. I recently spoke with Dennis Evanosky and Eric Koss about their new book, Lost Ballparks, which explores the stories of ballparks that are no more. And Dennis and Eric, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Our pleasure.
What prompted you to write this book about lost ballparks?
Well, the idea actually came from our London publisher. We have a publisher in London, England, and we've done a lot of books for him, and one included Lost San Francisco, and another included Lost Los Angeles. And this stems from the idea that we have also done books for our London publisher called Los Angeles Then and Now and San Francisco Then and Now. And Frank in London came up with a brilliant plan of doing books that had things in the books that were gone, and the Then and Now books had things in the book that were still there. And then these books sold so well and went so well, Frank in London says, Dennis and Eric, would you like to do a ballparks book? And we said, we sure would, Frank. So we have to put the credit on our boy in London, Frank Hopkins.
How many ballparks did you research and write about?
You know, I'm not sure how many made the cut, to tell you the truth.
We researched a lot more than actually made the book.
Yeah,
but I guess that's what makes a really good book is when you can turn some stuff down.
Right. Right.
But we did something like. Wasn't it 60?
Yeah. Frank asked us to research 60 ballparks and paid us to research 60 ballparks. And what the idea was, not all 60 would make it. And it just depends on, you know, to tell you the truth, I never did a final count as to whether, as to how many Frank asked. I know I was disappointed to see that Frank left a couple out that I wanted to see in. And there's one interesting thing is Oakland, California, where I live, has a real famous ballpark from the Oakland Oaks. And Frank didn't want to put the Oakland Oaks in. And I said, Frank, if you don't put the Oakland Oaks in, I'm not going to do the book. So he agreed to put the Oakland Oaks in. So the Oakland Oaks ballpark is in the book. So it made the cut.
Oakland Oaks, when was that? Was that one torn down? Or did it burn down? What happened to it?
It was torn down, and then it's actually in the city of Emeryville, which is one of Oakland's neighbors, and it was torn down, and they put a Pepsi Cola plant there, and now it's Pixar Studios is there, the famous studios. Pixar is on the spot,
and there's like an IHOP on the corner, International House of Pancakes.
Right. So the ballpark is you wouldn't even know it was there. The sorry ballpark is gone, and like I say, Pixar Studios is there now. But when they got rid of that park, my guess in the 40s, it just got outdated and
the Pacific Coast League was
waning. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
The Pacific Coast League, the league that the Oakland Oaks played in, was waning, and the Oakland Oaks moved on, and the ballpark came down.
They're now the Albuquerque Isotopes.
Right. Yeah, they moved to Albuquerque, and we're not making that up.
Really, that's the name, the Albuquerque Isotopes.
Same, right. Yep. Yeah. We say sometimes you can't make this stuff up and
too funny.
But it's too funny. Yeah.
So what were your favorite stories out of this, Eric? What did you really enjoy researching and writing about?
Absolutely. My favorite one was writing up Ketchikan, Alaska, which had, I think, baseball history's only amphibious ballpark where half the time it's under water. And when it was high tide, you know, all kinds of stuff would just be deposited onto this ball field. And when low tide, came, they would have to see what they had to clean to make the ballpark available again. If the ball went too deep into the outfield, it would just be in too deep water to get to. So that was considered a home run. Apparently, like, the best outfielder on the team was this local dog who wasn't afraid to get too deep in the water and fetch the ball out. But apparently in Ketchikan, that was the only flat area they had to make room for a ballpark. And it's just funny that all the way back in the early part of the 20th century, even the smallest town had to have a ballpark. It was just part of life in early 20th century America. That every small town had its own baseball team. So Ketchikan, this little town that turns out to be the first incorporated city in Alaska, has this going baseball industry happening up there. And supposedly the Navy boys would go by the shipyard just to see the pitchers and catchers practice because Ketchikan had such a talented team. But there's lots of details in the book about that one. That's definitely one of my favorites.
Well, and even when the tide rolls out, the ball field's still got to be pretty mushy, doesn't it?
You know, in that particular location, there must have been all kinds of specific problems they had to deal with. I believe there was like a lumber yard in left field or something like that, where if the ball got caught in there, it was considered a ground rule double. Or if it landed all the way on top of some building, it was a home run. There were all these specific rules. And, of course, now this location has just been completely dredged away, and it's part of the harbor of Ketchikan now. So technically this ballpark is underwater today.
Hmm. So, Eric, what's your other favorite stories?
Well, I was kind of entertained by the story of the exhibition stadium in Toronto. They call it the X.
The Canadian National Exhibition Stadium, yeah.
That one, exactly.
That's it.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
The full name. Yeah. And just amusing how many people had bad things to say about that ballpark. And it was like plagued by seagulls who would come kind of, you know, clean up after the fans, after the games, that kind of thing. And in one particular pregame training or something like that, this poor guy, Dave Winfield, Yankees outfielder, it was just like a rare happenstance event that he was throwing a ball to a ball boy and it struck a seagull and killed it. And believe it or not, they felt that they needed to arrest him over this. They thought that he had done it intentionally. He was, of course, cleared of all charges, but just kind of interesting. I think that's the only time I've really heard about a bird being killed in the middle of a baseball game. I'm sure it's happened before, but we have that one documented.
Right.
At the Toronto State.
Right, exactly. It's on page 99.
And I think even the Blue Jays owner at the time said it had to be the worst stadium in all of sports.
Right, yeah. They pretty much agreed that it was just kind of set up the wrong way. A lot of the seats were way too far from the action, and right. The weather coming off the lake was made it real cold, kind of like a candlestick out here in San Francisco.
Right, right. I got one about the worst stadium ever built in San Francisco.
Okay.
You wouldn't even know it was there today. The San Francisco baseball team, Pacific Coast League baseball team, the Seals, they played in for one season only in a field called Ewing Field, named for the team's owner who built it. And what's really funny about this one is you wouldn't even know the stadium was there. You can go down to San Francisco today to Masonic and Turk, and just a little bit down the street, you'll find a place called Ewing Terrace. And you can walk around Ewing Terrace. It's a little circle that takes you back to Masonic. And that's where the baseball field used to be. And you would not even know the ball field was there at all. And the reason it's not there, that's right in San Francisco's famous fog zone. They built that stadium for the Seals to move away from another one that was kind of fallen down. And they played one season there only for two reasons. One was the fog. It got so foggy there during the games that they said they had to telegraph the outfielder to tell them it was time to come in for the to bat. And so the fog, not only was the fog bad, but whoever designed the field designed it to make it real easy to sneak into the game. So you could get in for free,
and it's just absolutely positively the worst idea ever. The only thing about the field that was of any interest was the fact that it was fireproof. San Francisco had just gone through the great San Francisco earthquake and fire when they built this place. And the Seals only played in that state in that stadium for one season, and that was all because of the fog. They said, bye, we're going back to our old stadium. And they didn't have anything to do with it. And they sold the property to the Catholic Church. And then the Catholic Church sold the property to a developer, and the developer simply took the place down, put Ewing Terrace through, and put all these wonderful, beautiful homes there now. And that's all that was there. I went over there one time to have a look. I stopped two people on Ewing Terrace to ask them if they knew anything about the baseball park, and neither one of them did. Huh. They had no idea. No idea that there was a baseball park there. And then just for fun, I stopped a couple of people out on Masonic, and they had no idea. I said, "Do you know why this is called Ewing Terrace?" And they had no idea.
Wow. So, hey Dennis, yeah. The Polo Grounds in New York. I've always wondered about that one. How did that?
I was finally delighted to find out why they were called the Polo Grounds in the first place, and the reason is there were two baseball teams. One was called the Metropolitans, and the other one was called the Gothams. And they were looking for a place to play ball. And there was a gentleman who owned some property just the other side of Central Park, the northern part of Central Park, just around 110th and 5th Avenue. And there's a lake there on the northern edge of Central Park. And on the other side of that lake, the gentleman was trying to introduce polo into the United States. And polo did catch on. However, it didn't catch on in that field out there. They went out to Westchester County, New York instead. And so the ball players started playing ball there. And the Metropolitans and the Gothams played ball there. They divided the grounds into Eastern and Western Diamonds. But then in 1889, the city forced the teams out. They got to find a new home. And I have the gentleman who I owe a lot of this information to, Bill Lamb, told me that the Giants built a new polo grounds at the very northern tip of Manhattan, hard by the Harlem River, in Bill's words. And then that was up on the bluff, on Coogan's Bluff, up on the hill. And then finally they go down, they built another park down in Coogan's Hollow, and that's where everybody knows. When you say the polo grounds to ball fans, it's the ballpark in Coogan's Hollow, which is gone now. There's apartment houses there, but it was the one in Coogan's Hollow that everybody knows as the Polo Grounds. But a lot of ball fans don't know anything about the story about the Polo Grounds. It was just to the north of Central Park when the Metropolitans and the Gothams were playing ball.
And something I never knew, this is really interesting from your book, I never knew there were two Wrigley Fields at one time. That you had the one in Chicago, and then you had the one in L.A. as well. How did that happen?
What happened is, actually, technically, I think there were even three.
I
think there was one out on Catalina Island because Mr. Wrigley owned that island, and he had their spring training facility out there.
I'll have
to double-check that.
Yeah. Mr. Wrigley had too much money.
Yeah.
You know, the chewing gum business was pretty good for Mr. Wrigley. And Eric is right. He owned Catalina Island, and as anybody would do in Chicago, he spent his summers in California. And so he essentially built Wrigley Field in L.A. Of course, we had the Wrigley Field in Chicago. And then, as Eric mentioned, we have the Wrigley Field, or had the Wrigley Field, out on poor Mr. Wrigley's island, Catalina Island.
Right. And then doesn't the Wrigley Field in L.A. actually predate Chicago's Wrigley Field?
I think so, yeah. I have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure that the one in L.A. is older, but Chicago, mm-hmm. Chicago was his hometown. There's no L.A. Cubs.
You lead off the book talking about the Palace of the Fans in Cincinnati, and that one set at the corner of Findlay and Western. What's the story of that? When did that start? How did it get its start?
Well, it looks like it started serving as the Red Stockings home field in 1884. They became the Reds in 1890. In 1900, this park caught fire, and the original park,
which League Park or something like that?
Yes, League Park. And that was replaced with this Palace of the Fans, which was a much more magnificent structure. It actually had little stalls where you could pull up with your horse and carriage in the outfield and watch the action from your drive up sort of spot there. And so it was kind of like a drive-in ballpark. It had a bunch of Corinthian columns. It had kind of like this throwback to the neoclassical architecture, which eventually would kind of give it kind of a dated feel. And they would want to replace it because it looked like something from the 1800s. But, you know, the most fascinating thing that happened there was in 1909 when this inventor, George Cahill, tried out the, a glareless duplex floodlight projector, otherwise known as the lights that make night baseball possible.
Really?
And, yeah. So this was a very, very early experiment in night baseball that took place at the Palace of the Fans in Cincinnati, and it was it didn't catch on right away. It wasn't until the 30s that night baseball really, really took off, and I think it was someplace in Indiana or something that had the first night game. It's in here somewhere, but that's when, you know, it really became more common for parks to be having night games was in the 30s.
But it was pioneer here in the field at Cincinnati. They did an experiment and it worked. I have a kind of funny story about this park. We were the last three weekends we were at History Days in San Francisco, and of all places we were at Mountain View Cemetery at their Tulip Festival selling books. And at Mountain View, a guy stepped up and he starts looking at the book, and he's from Cincinnati. And
okay.
He never knew about the Palace of Fine Arts. So
Palace of Fans, rather.
He had no idea. And he's reading it. He's going, I didn't know that. But the best part about it is not only did he buy the book, he came back 10 minutes later with a friend who also bought the book. Right, yeah, we sold out all over. We wish that one thing we wish we had had this weekend was more of these books. So we have other books, too. Eric and I have done 12 books. We're working on number 13 right now for the Cal Crew team.
Going back to the Palace of the Fans, what eventually happened to that place?
Well, like I said, they public a favor for this style of architecture kind of waned. The neoclassical style harkened back to the 1800s, and the city inspectors also noticed that the structure was failing. Floors, girders, and supports were deemed unsafe and in a state of decay. And then finally, another fire really forced the issue. In 1911 was their last game, the last game played at the park against the Cubs. And luckily, the Reds won that game 4-3. Later that year, the Palace of Fans would be demolished. October 12, 1911 was its last game. And then in 1912, the Reds would have a new ballpark, the Redland Field. Later renamed Crosley Field.
Right after Pal Crosley. So how much fun was it to write this book?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Some of the stuff was a little bit frustrating because we're interested in getting things right. And there's a lot of stuff out there that people just put out online, and some of it's not too correct. But all in all, it was, for us, doing something new like this was fun. But it's also a little bit frustrating because we are San Francisco Bay Area historians. We know lots about Oakland, San Francisco. We know lots about Alameda, of course, and so on. But we don't know too much about
Cincinnati.
You had to stretch yourself.
But believe me, there's nothing like seeing a book with your name on it.
Yeah, and talking to guys like you on the radio.
Right, and getting to go on the radio and being world famous.
Dennis and Eric, thank you so much for joining me today.
Glad to do it.
Dennis Evanosky and Eric Koss. Their new book is Lost Ballparks.